This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, American politicians consider U.S. assistance as Iraq battles militants. Amnesty International appeals for the safety of Iraqi civilians.
We've seen a huge number of people who have been displaced so far, who fled the region because of fear of subsequent violence.
The Thai junta chief promises an interim government is just months away. A scandal mars China's college entrance exam, and World Cup action gets underway. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. President Barack Obama says Iraq will need America's help to quell Sunni militants that are threatening Baghdad after seizing other cities in the country. And VOA's Michael Bowman reports from Capitol Hill, lawmakers of both parties are expressing alarm over Iraq's rapidly deteriorating security situation.
Speaking at the White House, President Obama said he is reviewing how America can best assist Iraq.
Iraq's going to need more help. It's going to need more help from us, and it's going to need more help from the international community. So my team is working around the clock to identify how we can provide the most effective assistance to them. I don't rule out anything, because we do have a stake in making sure that these jihadists are not getting a permanent foothold in either Iraq or Syria, for that matter.
The president did not specify any options under consideration. On Capitol Hill, Republican House Speaker John Boehner accused Mr. Obama of dithering.
It's not like we haven't seen over the last 5 or 6 months these terrorists moving in, taking control of western Iraq. Now they've taken control of Mosul. They're 100 miles from Baghdad. And what's the president doing? Taking a nap.
Senators of both parties emerged with grave expressions from a closed-door briefing by military and intelligence officials. Republican John McCain said the president and his team bear responsibility for the Iraqi crisis.
I think everybody in this national security team, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, ought to be replaced. It's a total failure. We are facing a disaster here.
Democratic Senator Joe Manchin said the United States has decisions to make regarding Iraq, but urged a toning down of rhetoric on Capitol Hill.
Playing politics with this right now is not a time to do that. This is very dangerous, and it's concerning for that whole region. I've always said this, if money or military might would have changed that part of the world, we'd have done it by now.
But Republican Senator Bob Corker said the United States cannot tolerate a situation he described as, quote, getting out of hand.
This continuing as it is certainly risk the entire region being just going up into flames.
Fellow Republican Senator Lindsey Graham urged U.S. airstrikes against Islamist Sunni militants. Democrat Carl Levin said there should be no rush to action.
We got to be very, very careful and thoughtful before we do anything and not knee-jerk anything, not to jump to any conclusions.
A Pentagon spokesman, Colonel Steve Warren, said the U.S. military is, quote, completely aware of the gravity of the situation in Iraq. The United States withdrew the last of its forces from Iraq in 2011. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
Civilians caught in the fighting in Iraq must be protected at all costs, according to Amnesty International. The humanitarian group is calling for all fighting forces to allow the public to leave the conflict zone safely. We spoke about the appeal with Saeed Haddadi, researcher for the Middle East and North Africa.
We're particularly concerned, about the potential rise of violence and the impact that we've already seen on people who live in the area that's affected by the ISIS. We've seen a huge number of people who have been displaced so far, who fled the region because of fear of subsequent violence. The number, according to UN sources, is over 500,000 people being forced to flee Mosul so far. And the impact of this, the violence and the conflict that the ensuing conflict that might soon develop between the insurgents and the Iraqi military forces.
And the people who aren't able to flee, they're in real danger.
those who are not able to flee, unfortunately, like in most conflicts, they tend to be caught in the crossfire, and we've been calling on the Iraqi authorities and the Iraqi armed forces as well as the insurgents to give them free access to leave the conflict zone and to not to block their way, but also to be very careful when using armed force to distinguish between civilian and non-civilian targets.
I understand you found there has been some indiscriminate shelling in Fallujah.
Indeed, and I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of people, if you see over the weekend, we have almost 500,000 people fleeing Mosul area because of the impact of the shellings on Fallujah had. And the fact that people know that during such violence, the civilians are actually the ones that are paying the higher price.
What do you hope can be done? Do you want the international community to do anything?
Well, I think the international community needs to call on the Iraqi government as well as on the insurgents once the violence starts to, they are engaged in more violence to spare the lives of civilians and to abide by international humanitarian law and international human rights law when the conflict escalates.
Saeed Haddadi, researcher for the Middle East and North Africa at Amnesty International's headquarters in London. Negotiations on limiting Iran's nuclear program resume next week. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports on some of the obstacles blocking progress with just over 1 month to go before the deadline for an agreement.
The talks resume at a time when U.S. officials say diplomacy is intensifying as people need to make tough choices ahead of a July 20th deadline for reaching a deal on Iran's nuclear program. Deputy U.S. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf.
We think we've made progress during some rounds, but as we said coming out of the last one, we hadn't seen enough made. We hadn't seen enough realism, quite frankly, on the table.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani says Tehran's looking for a deal that improves regional security.
We want the Middle East to be free, not just of nuclear weapons, but of all weapons of mass destruction. Our aim should be that all nations be given the right to use nuclear technology for peaceful purposes.
But President Obama's political opponents say opening these talks and easing some sanctions have only strengthened Iran. Republican Senator Bob Corker.
Even if we make it through this successfully, which I hope with every cell of my body we do, they're still going to be a major state sponsor of terrorism.
American Enterprise Institute analyst Frederick Kagan says Iran's nuclear program and its participation in these talks are a means to broader ends.
Iran's strategy in Iraq and Syria and Lebanon and Bahrain and Yemen and throughout the region has shown the enormous damage the Islamic Republic does when by the methods that it uses to pursue its aims. Iran does not fill vacuums. Iran creates vacuums.
Remaining differences include the scale of nuclear enrichment Iran will maintain under the deal, as well as the mechanism for lifting international sanctions. American University professor Hilary Mann Leverett.
The Iranians, of course, want the United States to lift all sanctions as soon as the deal is concluded, and the U.S. side is looking at ways to keep sanctions in some way, to keep some of them, and the ones that we do, in a sense, lift, not really lift, actually suspend, and attach triggers for immediate reimposition with Iranian noncompliance.
Center for Strategic and International Studies Associate Scott Modell says easing sanctions enables Iran's regional ambitions.
As it frees up money for the Iranian government, it is only going to embolden the Iran threat network even further.
U.S. ally Israel is especially concerned, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
I think as the talks with Iran continue, one thing must guide the international community, and that is we must not let the Ayatollahs win. We mustn't let the foremost terrorist state of our time, Iran, develop the capability to produce nuclear weapons.
Analysts say the Obama administration could help ease Israeli concerns by agreeing ahead of time on how they might respond to potential Iranian violations, including the possible use of force. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
Egypt's newly sworn-in president this week apologized in person to a woman who was sexually assaulted by a mob during weekend celebrations marking his inauguration. State television showed Abdel Fattah el-Sisi with a bouquet of flowers visiting the woman in a Cairo hospital. El-Sisi said, quote, I came here today to tell you and to tell every Egyptian woman that I am sorry and I offer you my apologies, end quote. Several women were assaulted during Sunday's inaugural festivities in Cairo's central Tahrir Square. These women were in the square on Sunday and said they didn't feel safe.
I first came here at the end of 2010, so before the revolution, I say it wasn't as bad as it is now. I always feel very uncomfortable walking around, and there is all forms of physical harassment that can happen to you and that happened to me before.
Journalist and women's rights activist Hania Mohib spoke with Sky TV, telling them she had been gang raped in Tahrir Square during a demonstration in 2013. Women's groups complain that tough new laws have not done enough to stop the abuse.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
For the first time since the May 22nd coup in Thailand, the general running the country has indicated a date for establishing an interim government. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
Army General Prayut Chan-o-cha says power will be delegated to an interim government in several months. Speaking to senior military officials and government bureaucrats, the head of Thailand's junta announced a government will be set up by August, or at the very latest, September. But the army chief, known for his blunt manner, added, "Don't ask me who they are or where they come from." There is speculation that Prayut, due to retire from the military in September, could appoint himself prime minister. In an address focusing on next year's national budget, the general, who seized power 3 weeks ago from the weakened caretaker government, reiterated a new temporary constitution is to be drafted within 3 months, but said it will be at least a year before general elections can take place. The army chief, while vowing to maintain a strong military, also defended the junta's tinkering in matters large and small, from setting price controls to calling for free-to-air TV broadcasts of all the World Cup matches. Prayut acknowledges criticism that the junta is conducting populist policies, such as adjusting the tax structure and capping energy prices. He explains that they are, in reality, temporary measures to relieve hardship on the people. General Prayut also announced that the ruling military body will not renew a controversial and costly scheme in which farmers pledge rice to the government in exchange for being paid 40% above the market price. Farmers are owed $2.5 billion for the rice, and the army has begun making payments. The crop pledging plan was a centerpiece of the administration of Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat, but was criticized for leaving unsold rice rotting in warehouses amid allegations of corruption. A court ruling on key elements of the plan led to her removal from office last month. One goal of the coup, according to a junta spokesman, is to eradicate the influence of the Shinawat family from Thai politics. Ms. Yingluck's brother, Thaksin Shinawat, a billionaire telecommunications tycoon, was deposed in the previous coup in 2006. General Prayut, an ardent royalist and career soldier, is appealing for patience, while noting the junta is enjoying a honeymoon period, which he says he hopes lasts longer. The general says we have to return happiness to the people, to all groups. He adds the junta will not do anything that will impact in the long term the country's fiscal system. He asks his audience that if he orders anything wrong to tell him, because he says, I am willing to listen to all comments. But criticism of the junta is effectively muted, as the media are operating under military censorship, while the army and police vow to arrest those whose comments can incite unrest or are deemed to be political. Since the May 22nd coup, several hundred people have been summoned by the military and most of them detained for a week or two. They include politicians, academics, activists, and journalists. Some of those released say they had to sign a document stating they will not engage in political activity or leave the country. there have been some arrests of those displaying defiance against the coup at peaceful small rallies, but a significant portion of the urban middle class appears to support the military's takeover. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
South Korean President Park Geun-hye is replacing seven cabinet members in response to sagging public trust after the April sinking of the ferry Sewol, resulting in 304 people being killed or missing. The major cabinet shakeup is Ms. Park's first since taking office in February last year as the country's first female president. Officials at the presidential Blue House said the changes include the finance minister, security, education, labor, culture, gender equality, and science ministers. Millions of high school students in China sat for the nationwide highly competitive college entrance exam earlier this month. The exam is praised for giving exceptional students a chance to go to the best schools, regardless of their family background or economic status. But a bribery scandal involving a college admissions officer suggests the exam is not the only way in. Rebecca Valley has details from Hong Kong.
Every June, Chinese media are inundated with stories of the hard work and the anxiety felt by students about to take the Gaokao, the highly competitive test that alone will determine who gets accepted to which university. In a country that places enormous value in education as a means to social advancement, high marks on the test are the key to entry into the best schools in the country. But this year, as 9 million students set to compete for roughly 7 million spots, newspapers prominently feature stories about corruption in the country's top schools. In one of the most prominent recent cases, Cai Rongsheng, former head of admission at Beijing's prestigious Renmin University, was allegedly paid to admit students bypassing the Gaokao. He now stands accused of accepting more than $1.5 million in bribes for helping students during the recruitment. Tsai's case has shed light into the so-called special admission, a channel of recruitment alternative to the strict score system of the Gaokao. Yang Rui studies education policy in China at the University of Hong Kong.
Gaokao really offered millions of people opportunities, and it changed China, after the open door policy in the late 1970s. But increasingly, academics and government policymakers realize Gaokao is not really fair. You know, many people are in much better position than those in rural, for example, schools. And also, schools themselves only cannot tell the whole picture.
Some universities in China are allowed to select no more than 5% of their freshmen based on extracurricular achievements. The move was designed to offer schools more flexibility to accept candidates whose talents did not directly translate into high Gaokao scores or were discriminated against by regional quotas that benefit urban residents. But the special admission has left administrators with too much unsupervised power, says Xiong Bingqi, vice president of the 21st Century Education Research Institute, an NGO that focuses on education research. He says there should be a process through which a student is recommended by the high school and then has to go through exams at the university and finally gets enrolled through a process of performance records. Xiong says the system has instead been hijacked by administrators who have power to decide over enrollment. Authorities have banned the practice of trading university admissions for money or favor. And the Ministry of Education has issued a directive earlier this year urging more transparency and supervision. He says the government would like to have policies to require that university presidents be responsible for the school's recruitment process. And there's also a need for a performance evaluation system. But the problem, he says, is that there's still no mechanism to keep the power of administrators in check. Scandals in academia risk alienating a Chinese public that is growing increasingly wary of the preferential treatment enjoyed by the rich and powerful in many different areas. Chinese President Xi Jinping has taken power with a mandate to curb corruption. He has dispatched special investigators to government departments, state-owned enterprises, as well as universities. The effort has led to an unprecedented number of indictments, but critics say Mr. Xi's approach falls short of reforming the system of unchecked power that breeds corruption.
I think the Xi Jinping administration is very determined. Again, the question is how far and for how long? And that's a question asked by many Chinese people within China.
The most difficult part, Yang says, is that corruption is widespread at all levels of Chinese society. He adds Xi Jinping cannot really treat all the country or most of the people as enemy. For VOA News, this is Rebecca Valli in Hong Kong.
China is a fascinating country.
With interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own, American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
Football's World Cup began Thursday with a match between Brazil and Croatia, with Brazil winning 3-1. But opening day was marred by protests against the tournament. VOA's Scott Bob reports from Rio de Janeiro.
Downtown at Rio de Janeiro's famed Candelaria Church, two members of the Black Bloc protest group, going by the names Rocky and Nika, say the government, instead of spending $11 billion on football, should have focused on social services.
Social equality, investment in education and health and public services.
School teacher Valeria Matos says Brazil's education system has deteriorated in recent years.
We demand improvement in our school system. We denounce the diversion of funds from education and culture that were meant for our work and our school materials.
Police in Sao Paulo, ahead of the opening World Cup match there, used tear gas to disperse a similar demonstration by protesters. The protesters say cronyism and corruption permeate Brazilian government. Here in Rio, a member of the Communist Party, Carlos Serrano, says many favelas and neighborhoods were destroyed for the World Cup. He says this shows that the cup is against the people, not for the people.
Brazil!
This is absolutely absurd, and it's why we're having this mobilization. We're going to continue until the end of the cup and in Rio de Janeiro, beyond the cup until 2016, when we have the Olympics, which is a replica of the same logic.
The number of demonstrators has declined as football fever grips the nation, but the activists say they will carry on until things change in Brazil.
VOA's Scott Bob reporting from Rio de Janeiro. While the Sao Paulo is focused on the games, residents of a local shantytown or favela don't feel like the party is theirs. Roger Wilkerson has this report for VOA Television.
Not far from these upscale buildings, kids in Moinho play soccer every day. Here, the noisy World Cup festivities do not carry much of an echo. With no toilets or running water, kids here learn early how to survive. In Moinho, there is no sign of the billions of dollars invested by the Brazilian government to organize the cup. Gerson Ribeiro lives in the favela.
I do not feel anything for this cup. Brazil spent money for the event, not for education. It's not fair. They invested billions of dollars for the World Cup, but nothing for health or education.
The few who have TV in their homes will watch the opening game between Brazil and Croatia. This cup is a real paradox for the people of Moinho, so close, yet so far away. The favela has been here for decades. The city of São Paulo wants to expel its residents from the site, but they fight back. Alessandra Cunha grew up in Moinho. Today, she works with kids to help them stay out of trouble.
There are people here who have needs, who have to be taken care of. It is not just a space. You have people living without water, electricity, or toilets. Some people don't even have a toilet inside their home right in downtown Sao Paulo, the biggest city in Latin America.
On the football field, kids keep playing. In this country where football is king, every kid dreams about being a professional and leaving poverty behind. Josuel Santana is 20. He still believes he can escape life in the favela.
To me, football is like a second life. Football is like marriage. I need to be faithful. I'll play anytime, anywhere. My knee hurts, but I never stop playing. I always dream about being a professional.
In the World Cup shadow, such dreams are priceless. To the beat of samba music, kids in Moinho always smile. it's worth all the trophies in the world. For French to Africa correspondent Nicolas Pinot, Roger Wilkerson, VOA News.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On June 13th in the year 323 BC, Alexander the Great, the young Macedonian military genius who forged an empire stretching from the eastern Mediterranean to India, died in Babylon, which is present-day Iraq, at the age of 33. Using military tactics that are still studied today, Alexander brought about sweeping political and economic changes based on ideas taught to him by the philosopher Aristotle. On this day in 1944, 1 week after the Allied invasion of France in World War II, the first of Germany's V-1 flying bombs was unleashed on London. A forerunner of today's cruise missiles, the unmanned V-1s struck indiscriminately, causing suspense and terror among the British public. On this day in 1966, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down the Miranda decision, which required a suspect in any crime be advised of his or her constitutional right to remain silent and the right to an attorney. The Miranda decision held that the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution required warnings before valid statements could be taken by the police. On this day in 1967, Thurgood Marshall was nominated to become the first black person ever to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. On this day in 1971, the New York Times began publishing the Pentagon Papers, a classified study of America's involvement in Vietnam. The papers showed that the administration of Lyndon Johnson had lied to the public and to Congress about the war. In 2000, the first meeting between President Kim Jong-il of North Korea and President Kim Dae-jung of South Korea occurred. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Egypt's former military chief, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, was sworn in as president of Egypt June 8th, following his victory in the May presidential election. That election took place less than a year after the Egyptian military removed then-president Mohamed Morsi from office, after millions of Egyptians took to the streets, objecting to what they claimed was Mr. Morsi's increasingly authoritarian rule. The past year in Egypt has seen a crackdown on Mr. Morsi's supporters, particularly the Muslim Brotherhood, and arrests and detentions of many secular activists. In a statement, the White House said the United States looks forward to working with Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to advance our strategic partnership and the many interests shared by the United States and Egypt. The White House said that while it was pleased that international organizations were allowed to participate in the Egyptian elections, we also share concerns raised by observation groups about the restrictive political environment in which this election took place. In addition, the White House reiterated concerns about limits on freedom of peaceful assembly, association, and expression, and called upon the Egyptian government to ensure these freedoms as well as due process rights for all Egyptians. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Marie Harf said that the United States believes Egypt needs to continue its transition toward a stable, inclusive, and civilian-led democracy. Democracy is about more than just a ballot box, Ms. Harf said. It's about how you govern. It's about how inclusive you are. So we are going to be looking at all those things going forward. Egypt and its people have made clear their demands for dignity, justice, and political and economic opportunity, the White House said in its statement. The United States fully supports the democratic aspirations of the Egyptian people, and we will stand with them as they pursue the future that they deserve.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.